Thank you for tuning in to the Helium Radio Network. You are listening to a rebroadcast of a previously recorded show.
I marvel at those who think that we're talking about implicit bias too much, because either you don't know about the data and how staggering the data is, or if I'm more pessimistic, maybe you know about the data or you don't care, or you don't care to know about the data.
That's Dr. Robert O. Roswell, Associate Dean for Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion, and Associate Professor of Cardiology and Science Education at the Zucker School of Medicine at Hofstra University Northwell Health. And this is Healthcare Confidential. I'm your host, Teresa Jacob Ellis. Each week, we bring innovators and experts together to discuss the American healthcare system. A 2015 study published in the American Journal of Public Health indicated a link between the attitudes of healthcare providers, the implicit biases they bring to the exam room, and outcomes for their patients. This is just one of many studies that showed that implicit bias impacted not only outcomes, but provider-patient interactions and treatment decisions. Our guest today, Dr. Robert Roswell, is a leader in advancing diversity, equity, and inclusion in medicine and is focused on the impact of implicit bias on disparities in healthcare access, delivery, and outcomes. At Northwell Health, and specifically at the Zucker School of Medicine, he oversees recruitment initiatives, pipeline programs, and innovative and enhanced medical curricula to build towards health equity and inclusion. Welcome to the podcast, Dr. Roswell, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Can you begin by sharing with our listeners your career path and how you came to this role at Northwell?
Yeah. So thanks again for the invitation. I think my career path is it's a bit of an interesting journey. I was part of a program at Brooklyn Technical High School. It's called Gateway to Medicine. And this program was designed this is in the early 1990s, was designed to get more diversity in medicine. And so as a high school student, I had a major in biology and chemistry and really was exposed to medicine at, say, 9th grade, 10th grade level. And again, this was a Department of Education, Board of Education initiative to get people involved in medicine and get more diversity in medicine. And so, you know, spoiler alert, it worked. I was exposed to the sciences, excelled in a career path in medicine, and went all through undergrad just thinking about this is such a great opportunity that I get to, you know, help people and be a representation for the community. And so I had all of that in mind when I went through college and then when I matriculated to medical school. When I got into medical school, I was that medical student who was always in the dean's office. I was the one who was always figuring out who are we interviewing, how are we accepting students into the medical class, what sort of scholarships we offer, how could I be involved as a first year medical student, how could I be involved in admissions, how does this process work, how do we start solving the problems of healthcare disparities? And again, in the 1990s, these were all of the things that I was thinking about. And then as I progressed to residency, I still had the same focus. How do we get more diversity into internal medicine? How do we create an inclusive climate? So now that you do have some people of diverse backgrounds there, do they feel welcome? Do they feel that they can succeed? And we know based on a lot of studies that how someone feels and how they feel incorporated or included into a community, a workplace, or a society, that really affects how successful they will be. So I started working on those facets when I was a resident. How can we enhance inclusion, you know, as an internal medicine resident? And as I went on to cardiology, I started doing the same thing. And you can see how this is folding, actually starting from when I started medical school, thinking about diversity and enhancing inclusion, and working all the way until I was a faculty member. And as a faculty member, guess what? I was doing the same thing. I'm trying to figure out how do we enhance inclusion? How do we improve diversity? How do we start tackling the problems of healthcare disparities and you mentioned implicit bias. How do we start tackling those things? And so I started formally getting training in implicit bias recognition, implicit bias mitigation techniques so that your own implicit bias doesn't affect health outcomes. And I started working in offices of diversity, equity, and inclusion spheres. I got trained by the AAMC, the Association of the American Association of Medical Colleges, in implicit bias and healthcare disparities. And so sort of taking a real deep look into diversity, inclusion, and medical education and health outcomes, and really started projects in terms of how is this really affecting patient care, and also developing workshop initiatives to actually, you know, change, you know, how bias and inequities are affecting patient care. So that's how it all started. And as you see, it rolled into, it morphed into sort of just looking at this on a national level and becoming a dean of diversity, equity, and inclusion, and really just that always being a part of my career. And you can see, as you know, I would say as soon as I got into medical school, it started, but the real anchor was that pipeline program, which really catapulted me into medicine, started seeing the differences. And then from that point, just moving forward and trying to help from day one of medical school, which is in the 1990s.
Yeah, that story really underscores how important it is to begin to focus on children, really, on young people, and helping them to dream big and to understand that their potential is limitless. But at the same time, I find it remarkable that you didn't just take that opportunity and use it for your own professional growth and development, but you really brought a degree of activism and advocacy to your life. So what sparked that? Was that something that you always sort of had burning in you, or did you sort of have an aha moment?
No, I think that's a great question. What sparked that for me is just remembering being the only one. And I can tell you, and this is the interesting point, because I'm reflecting back on my medical educational career and just looking at junior high school, where I went to gifted and talented high school, which was predominantly Black and Hispanic students, and we all were thriving. And then going into Brooklyn Tech, which is a pluralistic high school, and it was at that point, so there was like 25% Black, 25% white, 25% Asian, 25% Hispanic. It was like the perfect place to be. But I remember at Brooklyn Tech, I remember the advanced classes that I was taking. I took like advanced calculus, like AP calculus, and then in physics with calculus. And as I got to those advanced classes, like I was the only Black person in the class. Out of this great sort of society of the future of America, these you know, really successful people to be. And I remember in my AP calculus class, just looking around and being the only one. And as I moved throughout my career, I always looked around and I'm the only one. I'm the only one in cardiology fellowship. I'm the only one in chief residency. I'm one of few in the medical school class. I was always the only one. And being the only one is not fun. And so it is a lot of pressure, and it's a lot of implicit pressure, because you may not even realize it, but you feel as an underrepresented minority and the only one, you feel like you're carrying the weight of the entire community. And that's something that people may not realize. And as a Black man in a class, again, this may be people's only exposure to a Black man in advanced physics or advanced calculus. And whatever I do may then reflect on all of Black men or Black people. And so that's a heavy weight. It's a heavy burden to carry. And once I carried it and carried it successfully, I think looking back, I wanted to make sure people didn't have to carry that burden. And especially in medicine, being the only one and talking about patient care issues, it again, you have a unique perspective, and it's disheartening that there aren't other perspectives like yours around. And so if you're talking about a particular patient who has a social issue and you 100% understand it, and no one could even come close to figuring out why this patient is the way they are. And I'm like, this is my aunt, this is my best friend. I could definitely relate to this patient, and this is what's going on. And this is the mystery to the medical case is, you know, this X, this factor. And I just thought, like, wow, if I could lend that insight in this particular case, what other cases are happening where people are not afforded that opportunity and the medical care provider team doesn't really understand them to the depth that they should? And so that also sparked, like, we have to diversify medicine. We have to get, you know, students and practitioners to not feel like they're the only one, but really now it's like looking for the patient, looking at the patient and the patient outcomes. Like, that is really, really important. And that's what drives me, because, you know, sort of selfishly, I'll become a patient one day. And I hope someone will look at me and understand the dimensions of my cultural identity and how that intersects with whatever healthcare problem I'm presenting with to help solve it. And so a lot of this is just looking at, like, how we need to take better care of each other and patients.
I feel like you got to the heart of what implicit bias is there when you said that your colleagues, your peers, just weren't able to relate to the cultural story and the history and the background of patients. How do you define implicit bias? Is that part of it?
Yeah, so I think there's two things here. So one is cultural humility. And so you're thinking about cultural humility and cultural competence. So cultural competence was an older phrase where you would learn about different cultures and, you know, quote unquote, you'll be competent at that culture. And that phrase has gone out of favor because you can't be sort of competent at any other culture unless you're part of that culture yourself. So we've moved to frames of cultural humility, which is really being humble enough to listen to people and understanding the multi-dimensions of their culture, but listening and working with them and moving forward and incorporating that into care. And it's difficult to say to medical providers that you need to know every culture that exists and know exactly what's going on with everyone. That's impossible, but you need to be flexible and listen to people's story and probe about their cultures so that you can incorporate that information with their medical plan. So I think that was what I was referring to before about different cultures and how that intersects with medical care and health outcomes. So once you have cultural humility, that's great. But the problem is with implicit bias and sometimes explicit bias, but implicit bias is where you hold an opinion or you hold a thought about someone and implicitly, you don't know that you're holding that thought, or you think that thought is not affecting your decision-making skills, right, or tools. And it turns out, unbeknownst to you, that you are ordering tests, you are prescribing medication therapies that are different, that should not be different, based on race, ethnicity, gender, any demographic group. And we've done a lot of research about implicit bias, and we see the differences in terms of how medical providers treat people based on their demographic profile. We could give the example of a Black man versus a white man presenting with the exact same symptom. Let's say I'm a cardiologist presenting with chest pain, and they get completely different workups. And this has been confirmed with research with actors who have the exact same script, say the exact same thing. And when they present to physicians, they get disparate treatment. A lot of the studies have even gone further into looking at implicit bias. And they're doing something called the implicit association test, which is a test where it actually tests your own implicit bias by a computer module. And they can sort of see how fast you react to things, how quickly you associate one thing with something else, with let's say a race or ethnicity, and they can tell you if you have some predilection or favoritism to white versus black. And what they've done is looking at people on the implicit association test, they looked at people who had slight or moderate favoritism towards white, and then looked at their clinical care and looked at how they interacted with patients and what they were prescribing. And what they found was amazing and astonishing. They found that those who had more implicit bias towards whites, when blacks were in the room, they had shorter conversations, less personal conversations. The provider interrupted them more so. And both the patient and the people who were observing the interaction noted that the experience was rated lower. And even when you look at the chart, you saw it was documented. Well, the provider talked about patient needs to lose weight or patient needs a new medication. And then when they looked at patient providers who actually did not have an implicit bias towards white, but they were neutral or had, you know, implicit bias towards black or black physicians, their notes were different. Patient described that they were in sort of difficulty with their employment. That's why they're not taking their medication. We'll convince patient about vaccinations. Patient's upset, but got patient to have the vaccination. And you just see the depth of what one person who didn't have the implicit bias was able to elicit versus the quick interview. And it was like, you need screening, you need a vaccination, goodbye. And this is borne out in so many studies. We have over 500 studies that show implicit bias and how it affects patient outcomes from in the pediatric population, which is the most heart-wrenching. And there's a lot in cardiovascular medicine in terms of who gets chosen for a cardiac catheterization, who gets chosen for bypass surgery, who gets chosen for ICDs and pacemakers. You know, when we're talking about limb ischemia, who gets chosen to have their peripheral arteries revascularized versus who gets chosen for amputation? So black and whites present with limb ischemia, and blacks more so get recommended for amputation, where whites get recommended for revascularization procedures. So everything you think about, whether it's TAVR, which is a transaortic valve replacement, or cardiac catheterization, like knee replacement, hip replacement, you pick your medical therapy and you go through it. And all the studies have shown that when you adjust for demographics in terms of, let's say, you know, socioeconomic or comorbidities or all those other things.
Insurance,
exactly. Medicaid, Medicare, et cetera. That there still is this big disparity in terms of why one gets recommended for something and why someone doesn't. And then that downstream affects mortality and morbidity. And so I marvel at those who think that we're talking about implicit bias too much, because either you don't know about the data and how staggering the data is, or if I'm more pessimistic, maybe you know about the data or you don't care, or you don't care to know about the data. It's one of those, but
yeah,
like the data are staggering.
Right. And to your point, this is more than just about, well, this patient had a better experience or felt more heard in the exam room. It really does have significant life or death outcome consequences. COVID-19 has highlighted for many people the blatant imbalance in health outcomes for people of color. I was just reading that Black Americans are three times as likely to get COVID as white Americans and twice as likely to die of COVID. But this is really just the tip of the iceberg, because if we look at cancer, maternal mortality, diabetes, and heart disease, the evidence has been there really for decades. Why do you think it's taken a pandemic to bring this issue to the forefront for many people?
I think that's a great question. And I think with the pandemic, we all slowed down a little bit. There's nothing else to do. We really are reading more. We're paying more attention to life. And I think we're developing more empathy. We're becoming more humanistic. And we all also can pay more attention to what's going on the TV, on the news. And we're not as wrapped up with our fast-paced lives. And so I think with slowing down a little bit and really taking a deeper dive into what's going on into the community and the world, I think that has really shined this bright light on the healthcare disparities that I've been telling people about for decades and others have been publishing. But now I think people have really just seen the devastating outcomes of COVID, and especially how it affects Black and Hispanic communities, and are really, I think, shocked and upset, which is good. And I know some will say, why did we take so long to get here to really realize these healthcare disparities? But as someone who's been researching and teaching about equity and inclusion, healthcare disparities, I don't really care right now. I care that we realize it and now we can work on it. And I think there is a lot of empathy towards these healthcare disparities, and they become topics of national conversations. And so I think that's the reason why we realize it now and didn't realize it before. And I'm happy, and I'm happy not to look back. I'm happy to keep on looking forward, and so that we could continue to try and solve these problems moving forward. And we've been just seeing the devastation with COVID and how it's impacted communities of color. I think it's really important for those that are listening to know that the impacts are happening mostly because of the social determinants of health. So there is not anything, I think, structurally or biologically that's different between Black people, Hispanic people, Asian people, or white people that are causing the differences that we're seeing in the incidence of COVID or the mortality. It's all the social determinants of health. And social determinants of health, I mean, where people are employed. If they're frontline workers and they have to be, they're the necessary workers, who they live with, their socioeconomic status, their education, and all of these tie in to what actually makes Blacks and Hispanics higher risk for contracting COVID. If someone in the family got COVID, how do you think someone who is low income, who lives in a one or two bedroom apartment with the entire family, can they socially distance? And those are the reasons that we see higher incidence in Black and Hispanic communities. Those are the people who had to take the train to come to work while everyone else could work remotely from home on Zoom calls. And then I'll just take this one step further. We should think as a society, since we're looking into these healthcare disparities, why is it so disparate? Why is it that Blacks and Hispanics have lower socioeconomic status, have higher population density in their homes, have less education that leads them to jobs that expose them to higher risk with COVID? I think that's the question we should all ask ourselves. Why are we building and perpetuating a system that perpetuates structural inequities? And when I talk about the structural inequities, is that we build things into policy, whether it's having insurance or getting a loan or where people live or how they're educated and their employment potential. We build that all into the system, and then it produces these horrible negative social determinants of health that impact morbidity and mortality. And then at the end of the day, we ask ourselves, well, why? Wow, this is really bad that this is happening. We have to do something about it. But we do have to do something about it because we created the system that perpetuates all of this. And that's when people talk about structural racism or structural inequities. It's not that there's a one person who's like a very racist person. It could be the implicit nature of designing policy where there was a blind spot and created all of these inequities. And they're so ubiquitous because they permeate policies, initiatives, and the way we function. And so I'm just saying this because I tend to hear people say, well, we talk about racism too much. We talk about structural inequities too much. But we have to realize it's such in the DNA and the fabric of our society that that's why we're trying to talk about it, because people have to understand where it exists because I alone can't do it. Teresa, you alone can't do it. We need people in their jobs and sectors to understand how policies affect people, and so that we can begin to unravel that and disentangle structural inequity and improve these healthcare disparities.
And when we look at it through that lens, we realize this is not a healthcare issue. This is a society issue. Right. This is a much broader issue that healthcare can attempt to mitigate some of these aspects of it. But really, until we get underneath and look at those policies, we're not going to really turn the tide significantly.
Correct. And I think the disparities that COVID has highlighted in Black and Hispanic communities are structural problems. So they need structural solutions. And the structural solutions are not from Northwell alone. They have to be in combination with the government and how we sort of assign care. It has to be in terms of education, how we educate our communities, employment opportunities, and healthcare opportunities. So it actually is a societal thing where we have to work with each other in leadership,
right,
to help solve these problems.
Yeah, it's housing, it's education, it's
absolutely, absolutely.
There's a clinician listening that wants to kind of make sure that they're focusing on this within their practice or within their scope. What are some things that they can do? Practical tips, and also what do you see as kind of the progress that we've made and where we're going?
So I think starting from what physicians can do, I think the first thing that physicians can do is to educate themselves about implicit bias. So we have on our Northwell site, the Center for Equity of Care, we have implicit bias workshops where we educate about how it works, how you can mitigate your own bias, how you can take an implicit association test. And this is easy. If you just Google implicit association test, they have an implicit association test by race, ethnicity, by language, obesity, you know, presidents. They have everything that you could think about. You can see if there's some implicit association with that. So I would encourage people to start looking into their own biases, and if interested, to reach out to us at the Center of Equity of Care to actually get workshops for their groups, because it's really important. The most important time where implicit bias can affect patient outcomes is when the physician or the healthcare provider is generating a differential. Because if you don't think about, let's say, this certain disease affecting these types of people, then you're just lost at that point. And that's a really important juncture. And we recommend that physicians pause when they're thinking of their differential, to slow down and think of, is there anything I might be missing at this point? That's one sort of branch point. The second is when you're actually assigning treatment. So if you are thinking that this patient should get this treatment versus that treatment, that's a time to pause. If this were myself or my parents, like, is this the right thing to do? And then especially if you're not gonna give somebody the treatment, like, I don't think they need a referral for X. That's a time to pause, slow down in your busy day, and think, well, if this were a man instead of a woman, would I have done the referral? Or if this were a different, is there something else going on why I'm not referring patient for this procedure or this referral, et cetera? And I think those are really practical points in your day where you can just pause for like 10 seconds just to ensure that you're thinking through these possible biases that can affect patient outcomes. And we're doing this, and this is what we're doing at the medical school when we're generating differential. This is exactly the exercises that we do. We go through a lot of cases and show them exactly where to pause, exactly how to interrogate their own biases, and exactly how to mitigate it. And again, you may not be able to erase your biases because the biases are probably there for a reason, but what we don't want is your biases to affect your decision-making and patient outcomes. So we talk about how to handle that and maneuver around that, which is, I think, is very important. So there are the practical things that physicians and everyone can do in their office, and there's workshops where we can go into greater detail. But I think as a health system, how we move forward with this is to actually engage people. I'm optimistic, as you were asking. I'm optimistic because I think we're at the time when people are actually thinking about these things. COVID has highlighted it. People want to enact certain things and change this. There are not many people I hear saying, yeah, I think health disparities should continue. Most are like, how do we as a society move forward and stop health disparities from perpetuating? So I think I'm optimistic that we have more brain power, and this is what these difficult decisions need. We need a lot of people who are thinking different ways to come up with strategies and solutions to solve these problems. You know, what we're doing at Northwell and at the School of Medicine is actually doing just that. We're putting together teams of community health experts. We're talking about social determinants of health. We're educating people about that. We are taking a community approach to healthcare. So the good health delivery systems, I think, are reaching out to the community, especially with the COVID vaccine, just reaching out to communities to enhance trust and build relationships in those communities so that we can deliver more equitable care and treatment. So some of the things, for example, is Northwell going into underserved communities and setting up vaccination pods. We're moving from a structure of we're the big health system, you come to us, moving more so that people can come to us, but hey, we're actually gonna come to you in the community. And by doing that, we're trying to level the playing field. For example, if there's transportation issues or other local issues in communities that we're unaware of, it's not that people don't want the vaccine, it's maybe they can't figure out how to get it on the internet. They can't navigate that because of the digital divide. They don't have transportation to get to a vaccine. But so all of those things are how health inequities further health disparities. So if we can come to communities and level the playing field and bring the vaccine to them, for example, that's one way we could move and advance on our way to health equity. And so those are some of the things that we're doing, is figuring out in healthcare delivery, it's so complicated. How can we be more equitable? What are our blind spots as healthcare delivery system? And how could we maneuver to make sure that we are getting to under-resourced communities? And I think that sort of structure takes coordination with community leaders, with government officials, elected officials. And as you can see, it's building that bridge that I'm talking about, that network of people who can work to fix structural problems. Because again, it's not the healthcare delivery organization alone. It's the government, it's education, it's the community leaders. And I think Northwell is starting to get on that track where at least we have community and some of the elective officials helping us to deliver good healthcare. So I think we're on a good track. And I think we're gonna lead the way, because I think this is the way that you can actually address structural inequities, is by taking these structural steps.
Well, I agree that we're on the way. And I think with people like you in leadership roles, the future is bright. And I want to thank you for taking the time to share your perspective and your thoughts with us here on Healthcare Confidential. Dr. Robert Roswell, where can listeners learn more? Is there a website they can go to where they can learn more about these initiatives?
Yeah, I think you could look on the website on Hofstra's website, the Office of Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion, which is medicine.hofstra.edu/diversity. Or you could also look at the Northwell Center for Equity of Care, which is northwell.edu/CEC. And I think there will be a lot of information about what we're doing, and particularly about initiatives that we're offering, workshops. I think those are great places to look for resources.
Perfect. Thank you. And I want to remind listeners also that new Healthcare Confidential episodes are available on heliumradio.com on Mondays at 10 a.m. on the Care One Network and at 2 p.m. on the Life Improvement Radio Network. You can listen on demand wherever you access podcasts. Our show is produced by Life Improvement Media with thanks to Eric Rimmel and Justin Ulrich. Our theme song is an original composition written and performed by the fantastic Patrick Pekarsik. And before we go, I want to remind listeners also that the 5th Annual Toolkit for Independence, a virtual conference dedicated to the success of America's independent doctors, will be held on March 25th from 5:30 to 9:30 p.m. Eastern Time. Secure your free guest ticket or join us as a sponsor. Learn more at toolkitforindependence.com. That's toolkitforindependence.com. And if you enjoyed the show, please subscribe and leave us your feedback and help us continue the conversation on the Healthcare Confidential Facebook page. Be well, everyone.
Thank you for listening to Helium Radio. The views expressed by show hosts or their guests are their own and should not be construed in any way as advice from Helium Radio. We make no recommendations or endorsements for radio show programs, services, or products mentioned on air or on our website. Personal perspectives expressed by producers, writers, and editors will always be presented as such. Any rebroadcast or retransmission without the express written consent of Helium Radio is strictly prohibited. Thanks for listening.